Controversy is raging over the credibility of the national election results in neighboring Mozambique. We speak to Tashias Jacobs, the Mozambique analyst for the private risk management company Focus Group. Welcome, Tashias. Thank you for making time.
Thank you for having me.
Right. Please recap the election results for our viewers.
Yeah, so election results, as expected, Frelimo won. So there was a presidential election and the legislative elections, and Frelimo won both. The presidential elections, the candidate Daniel Chapo won in every province. On the legislative side, the Frelimo party actually increased their seats in parliament by 11 seats. But Frelimo aside, the main candidate that was expected to oppose Chapo was Venancio Mondlane. He got about 20% nationally of the votes, or of the approved votes, that is. So just a brief intermission in context on how it works is the National Elections Commissions in Mozambique, they count the election results from all of the polling station, or at least the district polling station results sheets that are sent to them, and then they decide to approve the election results or ask for recount in certain areas. And then once that is approved, it goes to the Constitutional Council. And if they approve the election results, then it's finalized. So what we now have is sort of the preliminary election results. So I say approved, but with an asterisk, because it may still be subject to change depending on what the Constitutional Council say. But yeah, for the time being, the approved results indicate then that Mondlane got 20%, so obviously losing to Chapo. In the National Assembly, the parliament, the party that has been associated with Mondlane, Podemos, they have got it. And before this, they were a non-parliamentary party, which means that, you know, they did not have a seat, and they were considered almost irrelevant in Mozambique's political landscape. They have managed to secure themselves 31 seats in the National Assembly, and this means they are now the main opposition party. For many, many years, Renamo was the main opposition party, and they had 60 seats in 2019, and now they only have 20, which is a big fall for them. Renamo's candidate, Moussoufa Mamadé, also fell significantly in the presidential election support, dropping to 5.8% of the votes. Frelimo won as expected. There's some controversy to talk about on in that regard. Mondlane came in close second, but we've discussed this a bit. The issue with Mondlane coming in second is it is a bit of an all or nothing for him. If he does not win, he, as a candidate alone, faces a bit of a risk of being, you know, relevant over the long term. The fact that his party, Podemos, won is at least something for him. And there are talks of him becoming party president somewhere in the future. It is worth mentioning that Mondlane was kind of independent, but for him to have any power in the government, he didn't need a party on the legislative election side. He first went to an umbrella coalition called the CAD-CID, and they were kind of blocked from getting into the legislative elections because it was said they don't have enough support. And he had to make a last-minute decision to get support elsewhere, and he ended up aligning with Podemos. So it's not to say that he is as closely associated with Podemos as, you know, Chapo is with Frelimo or Mamadé is with Renamo. He is sort of still independent, but with support from them. So even then, if Podemos decides, listen, we don't want to be associated with Mondlane, then he faces the risk of just not having any ground. So, So for him, it is a bit on the edge here, and the election result is not what he would have wanted, obviously. And I think a lot of the unrest that we're also going to delve into, if you want, stems from this issue.
What have been the biggest concerns with the way this election was conducted, Tashis?
Oh, biggest concerns. I'm going to quote one of the Mozambican analysts. There was many of them. One sentiment that I read, the guy literally said, Frelimo will win with fraud, and he was very adamant. And this, in terms of substantiating this claim, Mozambican analysts did not provide much, but from what we have seen is there have been district courts that have confirmed that there were results of election manipulation. There has been reports from neighboring Zimbabwean investigative journalists claiming that they were actually able to partake in the vote in Mozambique, so not with them being Zimbabwean nationals, and they've interviewed other Zimbabwean nationals that have done the same. Again, the credibility of this, it is 50-50. And then the big issue that really stands out, and this is more subtext, Mondlane has a massive following, a massive support, especially in Maputo City, massive support from the youth. And the issue that we are seeing is that Chapo won across the board. In Maputo City, where it is suspected that Mondlane, that the race would have been at least close, in Maputo City itself, Chapo got 54% of the vote and Mondlane 34%. The race should have been closer. So there are a lot of questions in terms of all of that. There have been more serious allegations of election manipulation from the European Union Election Observer Mission, and they released a press statement saying that they were not allowed to observe the counting of the votes, and they are concerned that the National Elections Commission does not want to make public the district result sheet, essentially those information per polling station of the vote. The CNE refuses to make this public. So even the European Union is saying that, you know, the whole thing is, and there's been a lot of irregularities and it has been questionable at best. So disregarding all of the local discontent, all of the opposition are claiming manipulation and irregularities. And local analysts and observers, all of that aside, a big entity like the European Election Observer Mission is saying, you know, this was not a transparent and entirely credible process. So that makes the whole thing just a bit ambiguous. And again, from our side, we expected a lot more competition between Mondlane and Chapo, and the competition just was not close. And if it gets to that stage, all of the allegations against the election process, you know, it just gains a lot of weight.
Tell us about the apparent assassination of two opposition figures documenting electoral fraud, you know, the leaders of a team working on an appeal to the Elections Commission.
Yeah, so 18 February, or October, on a Friday, late, it was almost midnight, two individuals. The one was the lawyer for Mondlane. I forgot his name now, but Diaz was his surname. And then the spokesperson, I think, Podemos spokesperson, Paulo Guambe. I'm butchering that, sorry. So they were reportedly documenting electoral fraud, and late on Friday night, they were in Maputo City, in the commercial market area, and they were heading out. And some reports are saying that there were people around them, and when they were driving away, some of these people followed them. And then later, there was, 25 bullets shot into their vehicle, killing both the driver and the passenger, but was Diaz and Gwambe. There was a third person in the car, a woman. She survived. She was taken to a hospital and sort of corroborated the issue that people followed them and then opened fire. In terms of motive for this, Mozambique is just a boiling pot or melting pot of insecurity and a lot of issues. So who killed them for what reasons? That is a very open-ended question. But the issue is less who did it and more the fact that it did happen and the timing of when it happened. So you will not convince people, you know, a disgruntled electorate that this was not politically motivated. And, you know, in the court of public opinion, even if it was just common crime, it doesn't matter. And I don't think 25 bullets by the common robbery.
Strong message.
Yeah, definitely. And that's the key to it. You know, there's definitely a message sent. And these two were targeted. So there's a lot of uncertainty, but at the same time, you know, common sense tells you that this is obviously politically motivated. And from that, you know, the issue also, again, it's not necessarily that these people died. It's what it means in the bigger picture of things. Before this happened, you know, there was, we were discussing the issue of violence and unrest with local election experts in Mozambique. And the narrative was generally that it's a 50-50. You know, Mondlane called for a strike before the political killings happened. And all of our local sources said, listen, it is up in the air. It may or may not happen. Local election experts said that, now, we attended a briefing by the ISS, and there was an election expert who said that the expectation is that Mondlane supporters, while they may be disgruntled, they may not have the energy and motivation to spark widespread civil unrest and violence and protest action against the election results. Our local sources also said, listen, the issue with this kind of national strike, and I do want to emphasize that there's been strike and protest. Strike just means stay away, not participating. The issue with staying away, putting down your tools, is many of these Mondlane supporters, many of the electorate, their whole subsistence is dependent on the informal sector, so they have to go out, sell their produce to make money for their daily bread. And what that means is you can't really afford to stay away from your job, from, you know, anything. You can't afford it because it's a threat to your subsistence. And because of that, the expectation was that on the 50-50 side of risk, it leans more towards the 50 side that nothing major will happen, even though people are disgruntled. You know, they can't really afford to participate in this. And before the murder of those two people, it was expected that more likely nothing really major is going to happen, but they were killed and it served as a major catalyst to everything that we have seen so far.
Yeah, so the actual unrest then ensued and the police reacted to that. Can you describe to us what happened there?
Yeah, so Friday they were killed, and yeah, over the weekend we started getting flooded with information of, you know, what's going to transpire. And there's also where the emphasis got put on the national strike of that Monday. And again, Mondlane's whole idea was, you know, shut down, stay away, you know, let's honor these people by not being violent and looting and all of this. But people are disgruntled, people are frustrated, and, you know, that the emotion side of frustration drives people to just want to get it out. And want to do something about it. So in the early mornings of Monday, it was quiet. You know, I got to work. I was speaking to our sources and our information managers on site in Mozambique. And It seemed like nothing major was going to happen, but the emphasis was on 9 o'clock. And then from 9 o'clock on Monday morning, we saw people marching to city centers. Initially, the major issues were in Maputo City and some in Beira City. And then we saw it spread a bit further. Pemba City got a bit unruly. And then from there, especially on Monday, we got media flooding in pictures and videos. I would say half of it just fake news, people spreading around old information, but unrest across the country. We saw there was a video of Mondlane going to Maputo City, talking to the media, giving his statement of the state of things. And there was a video where the police started to disperse the crowd close to him. You could hear rubber bullets going off. It was a big ruckus, and eventually he ran away with two. After that, it was indicated to us that he went into hiding. He sent a message. I think it was a statement on social media yesterday, I believe, or the day before. And he said that while he is in hiding, he's not hiding from the situation. He's just taking security precautions. So that happened. And then on Tuesday, things started to fizzle out again through Wednesday. And then on Thursday, the election results were announced, and we just saw the whole story flare up again. Towards the end of, was it Thursday or Friday, we saw the internet cut. And we communicated with our sources on the ground, and the general sentiment was that mobile data was off, all mobile data, almost all mobile data, but your fiber lines and your satellite internet, obviously they didn't cut that, it was all still online. So the hyper-focus of that cut was on mobile internet. And it's worth mentioning that in many African countries, your social media is your internet. For many people, they don't go to a news website, they go to Facebook and read the news there. So it makes sense if you want to essentially cut any messages of encouraging unrest, you just cut the internet. So that's what we saw. And towards Friday, Saturday, it started to fizzle out again. We've received messages yesterday that Mondlane has called for another strike on Monday. He's alleging that they will be involving 4 million people. We'll see. Again, it comes back to the issue of subsistence. You can get a commitment from 4 million people, but if there's no food in the house, they're not going to participate. So there's a potential threat on Monday. So far, there's been, I think, 16 people killed. That part of the election-related issues, and many more injured. I speak under correction on that 16. It may be 16 injured that went to Maputo Hospital. Nevertheless, widespread unrest, violence. There was one video showing people on their way to march. I think it was from Monday morning. And the person taking the video said that they are participating in this protest action because they are unhappy with the government, with the election results. And what stood out to me was that they specifically mentioned the killing. They said they are killing people. Again, this shows what sparked anything into action. So that's 50-50. And this is what our security experts in Mozambique told us. Listen, if it's going the other side towards the 50, there's a very real risk that it can spiral. Because once you get that momentum going of discontent, of frustration, and once you're in it, you just finish it. So if it goes bad, it can go very bad very quickly. So we are seeing some days of intermittent stability. And this could probably be attributed to that issue of people need to make sure they have some income or secure their subsistence. but they are singling out days in which they are going and essentially protesting against the result. In his latest statement from Ondlane, he emphasized again, do not loot, do not destroy each other's property. But I think Nampula province saw a bit of violence. There was one video showing that they looted, I think, a local market or a hospital. If it spirals bad.
What are the international economic and security interests that have so cemented Frelimo's regime that makes it so important for it not to lose an election and stay in power?
Well, that's a loaded question.
I'm thinking of the income from the gas fields. That's substantial, isn't it?
Yeah. So the thing with most African governments, and it can be as stable and prosperous as Botswana, and as insecure and unstable as Mozambique is at the moment, is that in the majority of cases, your post-independence parties, the ruling parties that have maintained that power since independence, they tend to, whether it's transparent or not, they have significant interest in the mega project in the country. I can use Botswana as an example here to say that even though you can, if you can really loud and commend Thursday Rete Kama for what he did, and the statecraft that was involved in getting Botswana where it is today, undoubtedly that position gives you access to business opportunities, and that link may not necessarily be bad or corrupt or anything of that kind. It's just you are in that position, people want to do business with you. The same can be said with Frelimo. And the same is said across the world. If you are in power, people want to do business with you. In Mozambique, there are several gas-related mega projects that have been in the country for a very long time. They are one of the world's biggest coal producers. And all of that just filters back to if you're in power, you benefit from this position. To that end, it's entirely possible that some of the major stakeholders in the ruling party may have interest. And again, it doesn't matter even the level of power. If you are in power, there is an opportunity for money, and many people will go great lengths to maintain that power. With the LNG project in Cabo Delgado and it possibly being one of the biggest deposits of natural gas in Africa, there's prospects for a lot of big money. And if you're in power, all the more chance for you to benefit off this. If there is any current, let's say, direct links between the ruling elite and these economic interests, I think for the sake of being diplomatic, I would rather not comment on that. But it is a really logical thing. And we see it across Africa. You can use a small example in South Africa, for example, where you would see political killings on the municipal level, where people are killing each other just for a seat on the table there because access to power and money. So if you amplify that to the national level, there's so much more incentive to keep that power.
Now, meanwhile, can you give us a status update on the security situation in Cabo Delgado?
Cabo Delgado, yeah, especially so. Over the past 2 weeks, that has sort of fallen into the less interesting parts of Mozambique. And we've seen we have field workers, human intelligence, and we use open source intelligence as well. On the open source stuff, it's limited, extremely limited, the information you are getting. And we are tracking this up mostly to the focus on the elections. Your media are more likely to report on what's going on, in terms of the elections and unrest than Cabo Delgado, because that will sell more, because people are starting to get tired of hearing how bad it is in Cabo Delgado. For a couple of months since May, we've seen the Rwandan forces deploy to Makomir District, and this follows after the insurgents launched that large-scale attack on Makomir Town on 10 May. They maintained control over the town for 24 hours, and then they withdrew from the area, and that's a very important point. They were not pushed out by the security forces. They decided to leave the area. And the layperson may ask, why would you leave, give up control like that? Yeah. The insurgency is a guerrilla group. They don't need territory. The insurgents should only exist to be a problem for the government. That's all. So the attack on Makomir Town, keeping it for 24 hours and then withdrawing it, is a major message to the world that they can do this. They looted significant food supplies and they shorted thereafter. And the interesting of that attack, it was days before Samim withdrew from Mozambique. They literally, I think, 2 or 3 days before that attack, some big contingents from the Samim went to Pemba from Makomir Town. And then afterwards, the attack happened. After that, the looters applied, and there was a period where, like a month or two, where the insurgents had good logistics, and we expected a follow-up campaign from the insurgents, but there was nothing. Then the Rwandans expanded their deployment to make up for the Samim's withdrawal. I think they're talking 4,000, 5,000 Rwandans in total. And about, I'm not sure about the number, 500 to 1,000 were deployed to Makomir District. And what we saw was more of a containment strategy, really. The insurgents are located on the coast of Makomir District. There's a massive forest there called the Katupa Forest. And the insurgents have frequented this forest a lot since 2017. In 2022, the Joint Security Forces, including the Rwandans, they cleared out the Katupa Forest. And it was around the same time we saw massive insurgent activity in Nampula Province when they spilled over to the south. And then in 2023, the insurgents went back to the Katupa Forest. It's so dense, it just makes sense for the Birula to stay there. So what we've seen now is that the security forces are strategically positioned themselves on roads, on choke points. The Mozambican and the Rwandan Navy contingents are extremely active along the coast of Makomir District. And then there were some bombardments, but for the longest time, there was no ground contingent going in and dislodging the insurgents. And the issue with that is you can bombard them, but there's a book on this where they liken an insurgent to a flea in terms of, you can scratch them and you can chase them away, but they just come back once you stop. And so if you bombard them, sure, they'll move out of the area you're bombarding, and then the dust hit, they just come back. So without the ground contingent clearing them out, nothing is going to come of it. And for the longest time, we did not see that happening until recently. And the narrative we were working with is that they are employing a containment strategy to keep the insurgents mostly in the area. The insurgents are still moving northward and so on to collect food, because food in Makomir was not enough. it runs out eventually. So we are seeing sporadic insurgent activity where they are looting villages for food. But for the most part, most of the insurgents were in that area on the coast of Makomir District, and it created some degree of stability. For the longest time, we didn't see any massive incidents. All of the information we were getting is related to the coast of Makomir District with some spread activity northward. And our narrative was that they may have been doing this to provide some degree of stability for the elections, to have parts of Cabo Delgado, being able to vote at least. That seems to have worked to some extent. We believe Makomir Town itself, they were able to vote. There was enough security for that. Because those villages, they were not able to vote, obviously. And then shortly after the elections, we started hearing rumors that the security forces are moving towards the, so the two main villages is the Mokojo village and then Kitaraju town. The insurgents have taken de facto control essentially of the strip between Kitaraju in the north and Mokojo in the south. Like, Mokojo is one of the bigger administrative posts. The insurgents have controlled this to some extent for more than a year now. So the security forces have moved into this administrative post, and then it went silent again. And then shortly after the elections, actually last week, when there was this big hullabaloo of the unrest and violence in the election-related issues, that the joint security forces moved in and retook Mokojo village. And apparently they did so with little resistance from the insurgents. And it is expected now that the security forces might want to expand, you know, this operation. And this is the ground assault that we've been waiting for a long time now. So it is up, a bit up in the air what they might do next. As I said, the information from that is really limited at this stage. But we expect the security forces, especially led by the Rwandans, to clear out the area. One of the biggest issues, though, with this is that the insurgents are employing ground-based explosives, and you know, some media outlets are using IEDs, and IED is a very loaded term. If you start using that, it speaks to a different level of competency, of intent. And while we have seen some IED incidents, for the most part, it's landmines. And you know, for the guerrilla, this is the easiest thing to use. You put down a landmine, you can leave the area, and if the security forces strike one, they have to clear the whole road before they can get to you. So, and we've seen that, and this makes it difficult for the security forces to go in and insert dominance in the area, because you're facing this, you're facing a dense forest, and a dense forest is a guerrilla's best friend. So all of this makes it difficult. But as far as the security and Capital Guard goes, this containment or apparent containment strategy has allowed for some degree of stability. The risk that we do see, though, is if they clear out the coast of Lakamia district and the Katupa forest, the problem is, you know, if you disperse the fleas, they go everywhere. And that's the next risk for the medium term that we are now anticipating, is that if they manage to push out the insurgents from the coast of Lakamia district, where do they go next? A guerrilla fighter is extremely nomadic. They might go to Masumuda Praia, but there's another Rwandan contingent there. And what we've seen so far is that the insurgents tend to prefer not to engage the Rwandans. A guerrilla fighter prefers an engagement that they know they will win. And the Rwandans are fairly competent. So they tend to stay away from the Rwandans, and it's why we saw Rwanda so easily take back control of Palma and Masumuda Praia when they deployed in 2021, because the insurgents prefer not to. So if the Rwandans are able to clear out that area, we might see them going north to areas like Angade. The other big concern for us is that they might go south again. And obviously this poses a very big risk to all the mining activity that's in the south and the western part of Cabo Delgado. The insurgency, that they have a record of going south. They've been south several times this year. And they have also been west in the past. I think 2022, they went west into that Multiple Ways area. And Multiple Ways is a massive mining area. So there is a risk of them scattering. If you disperse the insurgents from these strongholds, there's a chance they can go everywhere. And this also plays into our narrative of why the containment might have been smarter for the pre-election period. Because if you scatter the insurgents when it's election time, it will look really bad, because the insecurity would just be spread all across northern Mozambique. So you want to keep it confined, make things stable, and then the elections can go off easier and safer. So that's the situation in Cabo Delgado. At this stage, nothing major and frequent going on, but there is cause for concern on the horizon.
Now, lastly, if you could tell me in one sentence, how do you see the future of Mozambique today?
I would say two words: status quo. There's a new president coming in, but it's the same party, and it's going more than one sentence now. It's a bit tricky. It's a bit tricky for Chapo because he has to navigate one of the factions inside of Frelimo, and you can't really shake things up without upsetting one of the factions. So we are seeing, at least in the short term, the first few years will be status quo. You will learn the ropes of this new position. As for the insurgency in the north, status quo in terms of we don't see it being simply ended soon. You don't defeat a established insurgency with military power alone. The U.S. in Afghanistan has showed us that, So I would say one sentence, long term, pretty much status quo.
Thank you. That was Tashius Jacobs, the Mozambique analyst of the private risk management company Focus Group, speaking to BizNews after the Mozambican elections. Thank you so much, Tashius. And I'm Chris Stane.